Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, wherever you are. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Jerome, back with Fundamental Principle, and with me is our very distinguished guest, Dr. Theo Howard. Dr. Howard is a freelance writer based in the UK. He's written for Catholic Herald, for 1 Peter 5, for... if you name a website that publishes good Catholic content, Dr. Howard has put his pen to paper digitally there, in addition to his very own podcast, formerly Vendée Radio, and currently the Two Cities podcast, available both on YouTube and elsewhere. And I think it's one of the finest projects in the Catholic Rite. So please, everyone, listen to our guest, Dr. Theo Howard. Dr. Howard, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, good afternoon, Jerome, and thank you very much for your invitation. You're very generous there. In fact, you even gave me a doctorate there, which I don't have. I don't have a PhD. I'm very glad to but you know, I appreciate the PhD there, and thank you for the invitation. As I say, I think that I've heard some of your interviews with our mutual friend Tim Kelly.
Yes.
Tim is
a wonderful. I cannot say enough good things about Tim. I think he's the of the people doing work in America. I think he's the best of us, and I genuinely am very grateful that he considers me his friend. But you are here because you have been talking about on your show on Two Cities about liberalism, big capital L liberalism, and I think that is in fact the most important topic in the church today. It touches the liturgy stuff. It touches the inadequacy of our politics. It touches the insanity of our economics. It only, you know, it's perfectly fair for Canadians to complain about being replaced in their own country, and just even to complain about importing all of Gujarat into Ontario. But only a liberal would even countenance the idea of importing all of Gujarat into Toronto and it being an acceptable thing to do. So, you know, could you kind of set out the philosophical, what you think the foundations of liberalism are and why they're erroneous? I know that's kind of a big question, but if you could just kind of set the table, as it were.
Yeah, well, you're quite right there to give that example of the immigration avalanche, the coordinated replacement of European peoples in their homelands by the liberal elites, and their, sad to say, for the most part, their acceptance of it because of this pathology of liberalism. All of these pathologies arise from that germ of liberalism. So I recall something that the French writer Jean Husset said, that with the revolution, being French, he was talking about the Great Revolution, the Great French Revolution, which was really the incarnation of liberalism as a political form. He wrote that at that moment, heresy took on a political form, thus affecting humans substantially as we live in communities. And the church thereafter became engaged in a fierce battle against liberalism, the mother of all ideologies. So as we consider some of the afflictions that have been rained down upon Christian civilization right across the formerly Christian nations, and these have formed from been dealt by various ideologies, socialism, I would say nationalism as well in certain respects. It is important to remember that they all have their source in liberalism. And there is an irreducible core, revolutionary core, to that ideology. So I think one of the best definitions that's given is within Pope Pius IX's document that accompanied the Syllabus of Errors, Quanta Cura. And if you would just permit me, I can bring that up.
Of course, yes. Well, and While you're doing that, I would just want to expand on what you said here for just a second. The revolution in France, and indeed the Freemasonic Jewish Revolution in England, which preceded it in 1688, are explicitly contra the Catholic Church.
Yep.
That there is no reconciling liberalism and Catholicism. John Locke was, there were some things he got right about, you know, not allowing atheists into public life. Sure, absolutely correct, Mr. Locke. But he also didn't want Catholics. And the American Revolution, right, was just as anti-Catholic as the glorious so-called Glorious Revolution, and even worse because it disenthroned Christ the King, and disenthroned monarchy itself, and then of course that led to the French Revolution, which was non servium, the satanic cry, given political form, you had these great 19th century popes like Pius IX, who was deeply sympathetic to someone like Jefferson Davis because he'd undergone the same sort of thing with the Rigiornamento in Italy, where this Masonic revolution, destroyed Italy, but anything illiberal, whether that's I would argue the Iberian regimes in this Salazar, Franco, Mussolini, anything, any attempts to turn the clock back is viewed today as not only all one and the same thing, but there's no room under the liberal framework to differentiate among anything. So if you are, say, as I have been in the past, deeply sympathetic to, say, Southern nationalists who want something like what Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson were fighting for in the 1860s in America, they view that as the same thing as National Socialism. It's just like illiberal men wearing gray doing bad things, right? And there's no, under the liberal framework, there's no differentiating whatever disagreements we might have on the right. It's all just bad. And Pius IX in Quanta Curia, I think he does a good job of it, showing how it's this totalizing ideology.
That's right. He says, quote, "Some men," referring to the liberals, "utterly neglecting and disregarding the surest principles of sound reason, dare to proclaim that the people's will manifested by what is called public opinion or in some other way constitutes a supreme law, free from all divine and human control, and that in the political order established facts, from the very circumstance that they are accomplished, have the force of right." So this is the core principle that all different shades of liberalism share, which is national sovereignty or popular sovereignty, the idea that ultimate authority in a political community resides in the people, resides in the population of that nation, rather than originating with God, which is flatly contrary to what St. Paul says, that the powers that be are ordained of God. So the church's teaching, as elaborated by Leo XIII in De Aeternum, is that that power comes from above, that only God is sovereign, and that since man is a social and political animal, God wills that the author of nature, God, the author of nature, wills that man lives in societies. Those societies need rules. Therefore, those people that make the rules in the society receive their authority from above, from God, just as a father in a household receives his authority from above. And liberalism denies this. And that is something that is incontrovertible and something that can never be reconciled with the true religion. And Pius IX points out there in the second part that they believe that authority follows power. whereas we hold that power follows authority. And as I say, that's irreconcilable. And one finds that all of these modern ideologies share that essential error.
Yeah, I think it's not only, I mean, obviously, Pius and I've, and Leo the 13th should be canonized, I believe. The fundamental incompatibility, liberalism isn't just incompatible with, you know, traditional Catholic piety, traditional Catholic politics, traditional Catholic economics, whatever. It's incompatible with sanity because it cannot limit itself. And you see this all the time with, you know, the people that think that Bruce Jenner is a pretty lady. Like, at what point do you draw some kind of hedge around whatever it is? You know, the church and traditional Christian thought put up breaks, put up meets and bounds of authorities, that, you know, the king had his rights, but also the sheriffs had theirs, and the barons had theirs, and the bishop had his rights, and even, you know, even against a bishop, you know, a rector of a cathedral or a pastor had rights. He could say, no, well, bishop, you might be the bishop, and I will obey you, but as the, you know, canonically assigned pastor of this church or the abbot or what have you, I can't let you do this because this is against the rights of, you know, my rights as XYZ, or and for the good of the souls under my care, I have to do, you know, this thing that you might not like. And even though Robert Bolt was like a diehard atheist, there's the wonderful scene in his wonderful play and movie, Man for All Seasons, where Thomas More says, you know, this is a land planted and thick with laws. And I would give the devil, you know, to do the benefit of the law for my own protection, because there were all of these very interlocking, interweaving rules and regulations that prevented abuse of power. You know, no medieval king was this despot that just could do whatever. Like the technology didn't exist, you know, to have this cartoon villain that was painted by liberalism of, say, Charlemagne. You know, he had to appoint local officials because he couldn't be everywhere at once. You know, to get from one part of his empire to the other would take months. So how can, you know, Christians at this point in time, I think the biggest problem we have, the Council, Vatican II, was an attempt to baptize liberalism, which has manifestly and totally failed. It's you might as well try and baptize Satan. I mean, it literally is just that ridiculous. Non serviam is the cry of the liberal. It is just Satan. You cannot baptize liberalism. And I think that someone like Archbishop Lefebvre, or I think you had the chance to meet the late great Bishop Williamson a couple times. You've talked about.
Oh yes.
One of my regrets is I never interviewed the man. They just saw that this was incompatible, and it was obvious, you know, 150 years ago when the popes were writing about it. It's even more obvious today. But how would we get the average, you know, Christian in the pews to understand that liberalism and Christianity are incompatible? I think that's our great task. I mean, really, because most bishops, I mean most bishops in the world, especially, you know, what was Christendom, are liberals at heart.
Yeah. Yes, I agree with that. Yes, I also agree that it is the great task for faithful Catholics today, and to deliberalize themselves as well, to excavate the layers of liberal assumptions which we might have assumed through the course of our lives, being bathed in this liberalism all around us. I almost think that liberalism explaining it is like explaining water to fish. It's something that is difficult, first of all, for people to identify, and then it's even harder to remove from oneself. But nevertheless, that is our great mission today. And because it is a satanic ideology, it is inherently self-destructive. And I think this touches on another topic that you want to discuss, that we are in a political, historical moment at which the rotten fruits of liberalism are becoming much more tangible to people, and the comfort that they've experienced, the material plenty, is starting to diminish. And that means that more and more souls are open to hearing about the incoherence of basing a society on the negative affirmation of freedom, which is what liberalism is, denying that there is a common good around which we can base a political order. So it is a difficult task, but I think it would have been much harder 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So things are getting better in that sense. I think I would say that we can have confidence that we're entering into the very earliest days of spring in that regard. So what we need to do, though, is make sure that people connect some of the ailments that afflict our societies to liberalism, and don't fall for crude conservative maneuvers which often attribute these ailments to, for example, cultural Marxism, which are in fact the fault of liberalism.
Yeah, the I forget who said it, but there was a Jewish, I mean, if you can't name the Jews or the Freemasons, you're lying. It's that simple. But there was a study done, I believe, by Princeton, that said that the most important thing holding up liberalism wasn't the hair on fire radicals. It was the Lockean liberal Tory political party in every Western nation. And that is essentially the complaint of every Republican is that Democrats and progressives are bad Lockean liberals, and that is true. And the complaint of every progressive is that the Lockean liberals are bad Rawlsian liberals, and that is also true. But they're both liberals. And, you know, it is the Tory party that has destroyed the UK.
Right.
It is the Republican Party that has destroyed the United States of America. It is the Conservative Party of Canada that has been responsible for, because the Tory Party in the UK was never going to sit there and say, you know, these new boundaries are ridiculous. This is Yorkshire, and we're going to keep it Yorkshire, and it was Yorkshire for 1,000 years, and we're not going to, you know, cut this up and do this and do that. No, this is Hampshire. We are going to keep it Hampshire. The good old laws were good for our ancestors. They're good for us. We are not going to pretend that someone from Yorkshire and someone from Hampshire are the same, let alone that some from Gujarat or Ceylon or, you know, Tanzania are all, we're all British subjects, so they all have a right to live in London. Like, no, they don't. And, to the extent, I'm perfectly fine calling myself a clerical fascist. I know that you have difficulties with that in terms of nationalist ideology, and we'll get to that in a moment. But all of this economics, people forget this is all politically mediated. You know, the laws of the agora, it's surrounded by a wall, and the rules of the agora of, like, this is the currency we're going to use, and you can't steal, and this is what constitutes fraud. Those are all laws set, and politics and economics are not separate fields.
Mm-hmm.
Man, just as if I take 100 pounds from your wallet, and that was the money you were going to use to buy food for the week, that's not an economic matter. That's also like a bodily matter for the Howard family. Like, oh no, we don't have any money for food this week. What are we going to do? Right? Okay, you know, it's integrative. It's of a whole, and this worship of GDP, whatever you want to call it, that tries to separate politics, economics, everything else. It's completely insane. You've talked a little bit about this on your show about restoring Christian economics, but could you just touch on that briefly of what kind of errors are made and what the Christian response to those sorts of because the economics is that there was so much prosperity unleashed by liberalism because, like breaking the bonds in chemical bonds in oil releases energy, breaking social bonds released lots of political and social capital that was temporarily used to, you know, increase wealth and do all these other things. But we're finding that those social bonds are actually more important than we thought, and rebuilding them is very, very costly. So philosophically, liberalism is incompatible with Christianity, but also economically, liberalism is incompatible with a Christian society.
Yes, and the field of economics was historically where liberalism, particularly in England, was first felt. I think something you said there, which I would hesitate in affirming, when you said that liberalism led to undeniable economic prosperity, I would contend that the gains in productivity, living standards, very unevenly distributed, but nevertheless that occurred, particularly from the 19th century onwards, were the result of new technologies, the steam engine, the spinning jenny, etc. And that liberalism itself likes to claim responsibility for those. But I recall that Dr. Plinio Correa de Oliveira said that if it weren't for the revolution, mankind would have reached the moon, 200 years ago. Now I, have questions about whether we ever did reach the moon at all. But the point stands that a Catholic society is economically prosperous because, as Leo XIII points out in Rerum Novarum, virtue in of itself leads to temporal prosperity. It leads to trust being permeating the economy, which leads to good trade, good business, good commerce, the flourishing of the human person. It leads to the right intermediary institutions for people to realize their talents, and the pursuit of the common good right across society. So I think that liberalism, has that great claim that it's almost like a sort of Stockholm syndrome or hostage situation where liberalism says, well, okay, we might start to acknowledge that this poisonous ideology has been responsible for the destruction of social cohesion, the family, social bonds, intermediary institutions, all of the things that temporally make life rich and lead to human flourishing. But at least we actually produced, we enabled the system which produced more stuff. I don't know if that's necessarily true. I think if we were to go back in time to the year 1700, and you were to compare sort of proto-liberal in some, maybe 1750, proto-liberal 13 colonies, Boston, Puritan Massachusetts, with the great metropolises of Lima in South America, or Buenos Aires, or Mexico City, the Catholic civilizations there would be far more advanced and prosperous than the Protestant proto-liberal societies in North America. There's a cratology at work here as well, and that's, to come back to economics, what liberalism ignores, that within any economic exchange, it's not just an entirely neutral field with the cold calculus of wants and the false premise of unlimited desires, which isn't true, but it's also based on differentials of power. And that's what liberalism did in the first place. In liberalizing markets, it destroyed small livelihoods, basically. And as I said, this was first seen in England. As an example, in England, you had the commons, which were areas of land which the commoners, the peasantry, the ordinary yeomen, could graze their animals and could therefore supplement their diet with protein, have extra produce which they could sell at market for some profit, and live a rural life greater than subsistence. And those were privatized in the name of free market, because the titles were in the name of the local landowners, the chiefly the nobility. And they were enclosed, and they were basically seized, and that resulted in great deprivation in rural areas. So that was a free market reform, which was to the detriment of the common good. And the kings did something to try and resist. They realized they were hearing appeals from the common people. Another example was the milling technology that arose in the 19th century, which allowed for flour to be basically denatured and last much longer. So it used to be that flour didn't last very long at all. Grain didn't last very long at all, and it would need to be milled at a mill pretty soon after being harvested. And that meant that mills had to be very localized. And peasants.
Why surname Miller is the most common name, or was one of the most common surnames in England?
Yes, indeed. Yes. The whir and creak of windmills would be a sort of a common feature throughout the land, and this meant fresh bread, which has all the attendant health benefits, slow fermentation with sourdough and so on, which people are returning to now, and. There was a license needed to actually have the milling stones, because it was such a vital part of the entire economy. And with this new process, which allowed for grain to be preserved, the newly enriched financiers and capitalists set about sending gangs round villages to smash up their mills, so that people would become dependent on the new technology of industrial milling, basically, and the much poorer quality flour and therefore bread that was produced as a result. So this was a obviously a direct intervention in the free market, but they were legally allowed to do it, it shows how there isn't a free market. There's always the dynamics of scarcity. This is an abundant world that God has created, but the enemies of the church, the enemies of Christian civilization, create artificial scarcity. It's a tactic they've continuously used. The ideological window dressing they have recourse to is given to them by liberalism. This is just the laws of the free market. Well, those laws, supposedly, of free market economics are based on false anti-Christian assumptions.
They are. And to your point, you briefly mentioned the commons back there. The surname Woodward comes from the man whose job was to manage the woods. Hayward comes from the, whose job was to manage the hayfields. The commons and the militia are the keystone institutions of the Northwestern European that allowed them to be high trust and cooperate at scale and enable them to do things like adopt Christianity and to spread all over the world. And they spread those institutions when, you know, with their empires, with their religion. And it is a lie of the worst sort that the commons are this, you know, this libertarian idea. And I used to be a libertarian, you know, because I'm an American. We're all default libertarians. But this lie that somehow the commons wasn't private property. No, it was. If you were in rural Lincolnshire and you showed up from Kent and tries to graze your animals on the commons for more than, say, 24 hours, all of the people who owned the commons in Lincolnshire would be, what are you doing here? You know, it was the private property of the people who lived there. The commons in America, the public parks that are being destroyed in America by homeless people, by drug addicts, by foreigners squatting in our parks, are being, those public parks are the private property of the people who pay the taxes and live in the town. And if, you know, your park down the street that your kids play at and you and your neighbors, you know, clean up and maintain and whatever, that's your park. You own it. It's yours. And this notion that you know, that there's no such thing as, you know, common property or private property, is that common property cannot be private property, is ridiculous. It's just the ownership is distributed amongst those who live in the area. And it was management of those sorts of things and cooperation required in managing those sorts of resources that enabled the English to be the greatest people that God has ever seen. You know, to take this one tiny island off the coast of the Eurasian landmass and to go all over the world and bring, I mean, you can argue that Anglicanism is deeply problematic in a lot of ways, but they brought the Christian faith and Christian civilization to a quarter of the world. And they produced Shakespeare and Vaughan Williams and greatness and beauty and truth for 1,000 years. And to say that those people somehow deserve to be destroyed because economics because it's economically more efficient to destroy these people, so we have to do it, is the sort of lie that only Satan can come up with.
Yeah, so it follows the liberal principle that distributive justice is not to be rendered at the level of the polis, but rather economic exchanges should be based on commutative justice. And it's, again, following that denial of the common good, which occurred with the overthrow of the Catholic monarchs, and enables the unshackling of just base greed to impoverish and immiserate the vast majority of people. To give another example, look at A1 protein in milk. It's not meant to be there, and many people who think they're lactose intolerant can drink A2 milk. And that's basically milk which is not poisoned by the single pursuit of profit overall. And this is because, you know, pasteurization is a really bad idea, but it's necessary if you mix milk from different herds for mass production, but not otherwise. So commercial interests bury this because their entire model rests on scale. But in fact, real milk at scale is impossible. You need local dairy.
Just like real eggs that are impossible at scale. And if you've ever had local eggs or eggs from your own backyard, you know, it's this rich golden yellow color versus the pale, literally pale imitations you would find at the Tesco's, I guess, is the story. But for Americans, it'd be Kroger's. But not only did that produce local prosperity and distributed prosperity, but it produced resiliency too. Because if everyone had a local herd of cows, say 10, 20 dairy cows, and there was a disease outbreak, then it would be isolated to that one herd, or you could isolate it to that one herd.
That's right.
And then that all the surrounding areas could, once the disease had passed, once the danger had passed, they could replenish the place where the disease had. You know, COVID-19, if it under, you know, non, I mean, we'll put aside for purposes of not getting in trouble, not getting you in trouble with the law, you know, who, what, when, where, or how, or how it happened, and whether there were governments involved or what have you. But if absent, you know, international air travel, right, and motor cars, like it would have been a local outbreak of a disease, and it would have been bad for, say, the three counties surrounding, Wuhan, and then people would have got over it. It wouldn't have been a worldwide plague that killed millions of people, supposedly. And I don't know if you're familiar with American gangster movies, but there's a film, I believe it's Goodfellas, where the Robert De Niro character busts out a restaurant. And what that is the restaurant owners owes them a bunch of money. And so they just start taking things, you know, taking lobster out the back, reselling it, drinking all the good booze. And eventually when he can't pay, they just burn the place down. Well, all our politics have been since the last, I mean, you could argue in England since Henry used the oligarchy to destroy the church. And, but the politics of liberalism is just a bust out operation by the Judeo-Masonic elites. You know, they're destroying things and taking what they can from the bust out operation and then proclaiming that, you know, the truth, the good, the beautiful. And as opposed to like, well, wouldn't it be better if all the children of England were, you know, healthy and raised on local honey and local milk and local eggs and local beef?
Right.
And the local miller was prosperous and the local farmer was prosperous and the local herdsman was prosperous. And you know, in a Christian civilization, that would be the ideal. And I think, ironically, the internet has allowed us to move back to the more distributed, you know, farmers markets are now a thing again because people could find each other and coordinate and rebuild those local ties. And certainly we couldn't be having this conversation. You and I wouldn't even know each other existed even 30 years ago. And we were able to coordinate this mass illiberal movement through liberalism's greatest project, right? We're all going to connect the world and everyone's going to be the same and get along. Like, no, actually, you connected the world and everyone found each other was different.
Yeah, there are hopeful signs.
There are. And I know you've got to go here fairly shortly. I apologize for the delay. What does illiberal politics look like in the future to you?
Well, I think the only truly illiberal politics is the social kingship of Christ. And that all of this this historical agony of the dissolution of Christendom is God teaching us that any attempt to build a civilization without him is going to result in ruin and misery. As the Psalms say, unless the Lord buildeth a house, they that labor in vain. And so it's a very pathetic adolescent ideology in a way of by which particularly wicked elites, but then the mass of the people following them are able to or attempt to retreat from God and his grace. So I think the possibility of an illiberal politics is limited until the crisis in the church comes to an end in God's time, and there's a resurrection of the church. But I think that we can still, first of all, immerse ourselves within the church's traditional political and social doctrine, and really understand the church's teaching on the obligation of societies to recognize the kingship of Christ, which is his due, and for societies to render true worship to the true God, which is the holy sacrifice of the Mass. They can know which religion is true through the apologetics of the church. They can certainly know that a creator God exists. That's the first precept of the natural law. It can be known through natural reason alone. And that should send men on goodwill on a journey of looking to discover which religion is true. So liberalism is a tremendous evil, a tremendous affliction, but of course God is working a greater good through it. So in the meantime, what I would say for traditional Catholics is that we should focus our efforts at the local level, that if liberalism uses power and might, which it has historically, then we should not seek to fight against liberalism on a battlefield of their choosing, but fight on our own battlefield and look to local institutions, local networks, friendships, families, and reconstitute the Christian social order from the ground up. And I think that's something that was happening in America right up until the 1950s, before the auto-demolition of the church. And so,
very much.
I think, yeah, returning to that path, which indeed people are doing now more and more, is very encouraging. We're seeing the formation of traditional Catholic families. I really hope that the next step, as we start seeing Catholic intermediary institutions become established, that is Catholic businesses, Catholic communities, Catholic hospitals, Catholic almshouses, Catholic schools.
The schools are being formed. The schools are being formed.
Schools are being formed, yeah.
For sure, that's definitely happening. And I think that because I don't know what public education is like in England, but in America, it's abominable. My old pastor as a child said he wouldn't send a dog to the local public schools. They wouldn't learn anything, and you'd get stabbed. And that's a particular problem of the United States. I guess it's increasingly a problem in the UK, the knife crime and everything else. And of course, that's mostly a racial issue, right? You know, in England, they hung every thief for 1,000 years and made England the most law-abiding place on earth, and then imported a bunch of people who...
Well, that's an interesting point, isn't it? Why does liberalism abhor the death penalty? I've been thinking about this quite a bit recently because, of course, the Vatican II, post-Vatican II papal claimants all have attacked the temporal powers' legitimate use of the death penalty. And that it's such a common theme. And I think that what it comes down to is, again, to follow liberalism's affirmation of negative freedom, the refusal to affirm any kind of common good. It therefore looks to attack the virtue of justice in the citizenry. And the great virtue of the death penalty, of capital punishment, is that it's educative, both to the soul of the criminal, as Pius XII said. It's not that the state has a right to necessarily take the life of the criminal, or it's not so much that the state executes criminal; it's that the criminal forfeits their right to life through committing a capital crime. And
you don't hang thieves because televisions are worth more than the life of human beings. You hang thieves because they're thieves.
Yes, and that imparts a lesson to the thief and gives them the chance to repent and hopefully to make a good confession before they meet their maker. And then it's educative and satisfactory in a certain sense to the entire population. They know that justice in a cosmic sense has been satisfied.
Yes.
I mean, if you think of the atrocities of something like Axel Rudi Cabana,
Welsh choir boy.
Yeah, this exactly this Newport, you know, rampaging round a girls' dance class, stabbing little girls. That his execution is something that a vast majority of the English people would want, and then that justifiably, of course, yeah, and that doesn't happen. And that is a liberal
and former Tory MP's wife who's in prison. I can't, Lucy something. There's a woman in prison right now in the UK.
Lucy Connolly, yes. Yeah,
Lucy Connolly, who's in prison for tweets.
Yes.
In prison for tweets. And yeah. and I don't want to get you in trouble. But I'm an American, and telling the English government to sod off is a 250-year-old tradition in my country. So I will say this Mr. Howard's opinion. The English government of today is the most evil government that has ever existed in all of Christendom, and every single person who's involved in it should be hung, drawn, and quartered, and their ashes scattered, and their memories erased. They are the worst government in the history of the United Kingdom, and things like throwing Lucy Connolly in jail while not executing Axel Rudabanga is obvious evidence of the maliciousness of someone like Sir Keir Starmer, who got his knighthood for directing the Crown Prosecution Service to attack patriotic English people and let people like Axel Rudabanga slide. He's the one who's responsible for things like Telford and Rotherham and mass rapes of English girls. And it's all Pakistanis who did it, you know. So this, it's not Muslims, it's Pakistanis. And I don't want to get you in trouble, Mr. Howard, but this is the sort of thing that liberalism, like by denying that there's justice or denying that their ultimate ends are the common good, requires certain things. And I don't know if you're familiar with the American writer John Senior, but he's written quite a bit. Dr. John Senior is a wonderful, wonderful writer. If listeners aren't familiar, they should absolutely check his writing out. But the death penalty is required, morally obligatory, because the criminal needs to know that there is justice.
Yeah.
And there are thousands, easily, of people in the United Kingdom who've done things like abuse little girls, sexually assault little girls, stab little girls, who are foreigners, who the English state has forfeited, has abdicated its responsibility of bringing justice, and therefore is illegitimate. And only because liberalism refuses to admit that the common good requires this. You know, the common good requires that all these people be sent home, or something more stiff than that.
Well, liberalism denies the common good. It just says we disagree on it, so we're just not going to talk about it.
Right. Yeah.
And therefore that implies that nihilistic hedonism is the purpose of life. Yes. But yeah, you're very well informed about English affairs, Jerome. And you know, the lowest circle of hell is reserved for traitors. The leaders of my country are guilty of treason. And as you say, there are just penalties that follow that crime. And it's a great punishment. It's an appalling situation we're in, but it's a great punishment that results in a huge loss of confidence in the people, among the people in their government, because it's kind of a delegitimization.
The government. What can, you know, to your point there, the Royal Navy, which once was, you know, legitimately ruled the waves, is a shadow of his former self. You and I both came to realize how truly evil Tony Blair's cooperation with George Bush's adventurous wars in Mesopotamia were, but it destroyed the British Army. Got hundreds, if not thousands, of British soldiers killed. I don't remember how many British soldiers were killed in Iraq and Afghanistan. I'm sorry. I do know that it was several thousand. I have rough ideas of the Americans killed, but England is poorer than Mississippi on a per capita basis right now, and Mississippi is the poorest country in America now. If England, that was the most prosperous, wealthiest, you know, in England in 1920, I always like to use the funeral of King Edward the Peacemaker as a kind of a high watermark for civilization. I think it was 1910, right? The 1911 Britannica comes out. It contains all the knowledge in the world. The world is at peace, and aside from revolutionary France and the United States, most of the world is under the authority of Christian kings. And even in France, there were stirrings of recognition of the folly of the revolution at the time. I personally believe if it hadn't been for the world wars, that France eventually would have come back to the faith and to some sort of... And liberals and Jews and Freemasons, but I repeat myself, basically destroyed the world from 1914 to 1918. And ever since, the nations of Europe and the nations of the world have all paid a very steep price in blood and treasure to maintain this illusion that you can, you know, destroy the foundations of a home and, you know, still live in a fancy mansion, right? You know, and you can't. You just can't. You can't undermine the English people and then live in an England that's worth living in. You cannot. I'm mostly of Scots extraction, and to pay attention to what has happened to Scotland in the last 30 years is just heartbreaking, because all the children move away. You know, the industry's gone. There are no, the jobs just, well, why is this necessary? Is there no longer grass in the glens? Can there not be cows grazing in those, you know, the Highland enclosures were a bad idea when it was tried, 300 years ago, and has no one learned the lesson? And I don't know what the solution is in particular, and everything I have to say about the UK government is a Fed post, so I'll stop there. But whatever happens in the future, just liberalism as such, it is illegitimate. You can't look at, you know, the Spaniards fought a 700-year war to get their country back, and they're the Spanish government of today that is spitting on the graves, literally spitting on the graves of Franco and the other heroes at the Valley of the Fallen who saved Spain from communism. It's replacing the Spaniards with Moroccans. And, like, wasn't that the point of the Reconquista, is to keep Spain from being replaced with Moroccans? That was the whole point of the longest war in history that I know of. And I don't think that, whatever happens, this present system, this present dispensation is doomed. And I think that, listeners, please check out Mr. Howard's work at Two Cities Podcast. It's on YouTube and elsewhere. We'll have the links in the show description. But I don't think there's a more incisive critic of liberalism, qua liberalism, speaking or writing today. So, Mr. Howard, I want to thank you very much for your appearance on the show. And hopefully we'll keep in touch and perhaps talk again.
You're very kind, Jerome. Thank you very much. It would be my pleasure to join you once again for another discussion.
Thank you.
God bless.
God bless you.